Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Well, this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Hannah Strum.
On the show this week, David and Hannah will be catching us up on the Berlin Film Festival, and we'll be looking at two very different versions of futuristic space travel in Dune Part 2 and Spaceman. We also have some absolutely incredible interviews from Dune's director Denis Villeneuve and Spaceman stars Adam Sandler and Paul Dano, all coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, should we start with the good news? We're back to weekly.
Hooray!
We need that like cheering children sound as the sound effect.
Yeah, Bob put in a sort of like roar of approval in there from the sound effects box.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a few gaps, but I think we've been able to keep the standard going, and hopefully, like, our listeners have been forgiving us for the odd week where we haven't had one. But from now on, yeah, every Friday you can expect Truth in Movies to be landing in your podcast app of choice. Slightly more less straightforwardly good news: the Berlin Film Festival. Shall we start with the positives? You guys both went. What were your highlights?
Well, I guess before talking about the highlights, it's probably worth mentioning at time of recording, it's kind of difficult to be talking about like the films and the filmmakers at the festival at the moment because, you know, of, you know, listeners, I'm not sure how much awareness there will be about what's happening over there, but there was a kind of press release sent out, I guess, after the festival had officially closed, if you count the kind of the final award ceremony as a kind of closing moment, that kind of brought up some of the speeches and some of the political activity at the festival in a way that was very unhelpful and very antithetical to the intended spirit of the Berlin Film Festival. And, you know, to my feeling, all film festivals, film festivals are a forum for ideas. And this kind of thing that happened, you know, very much goes against that and, you know, insults quite a lot of the filmmakers who have used the Berlinale as a platform to present ideas, not least, you know, filmmakers like Matti Diop, whose film Dahomey won the Golden Bear this year. And, you know, it is an amazing film about the strategies of decolonization and really kind of developing language to be able to talk about these traumatic legacies and repatriation and things like that, and specifically involving like artifacts that were taken from Benin in the 1980s and then took a long time for the sort of bureaucracy to agree for them to be returned. And the film is a kind of chronicle of that return, and that is done in this very creative, discursive, open way. The film itself is this kind of, or that there is an implicit stance about what it feels about this, how, you know, the taking and returning of these artifacts and the symbolism of the artifacts journey, but it's very much a film about the different ideas and opinions that come from such a journey and from this idea of like bringing these back to the place that they belong. So yeah, like, it's weird. I mean, in a way, it's a very positive sign that a film like that would be awarded one of the biggest prizes in film, but then makes this kind of statement that happened post-festival even more kind of strange and hurtful in a way. So yeah, it's been strange. But I'll pass the baton to Hannah because she was also there. So I've talked a bit about Matti and what a great film that is.
Yeah, I didn't actually get to see Dahomey because I couldn't make it work in my schedule, but I'm very excited to see it. I heard only good things, and I thought Mattie's speech, her winner speech, was really, like, I don't know, it feels so weird to use the word brave because it's making a speech, but at this point we've got to a stage where it is brave for filmmakers to speak out because so few people are able to, or people feel very afraid to because they don't want to jeopardize work, relationships, whatever. But yeah, I'm excited to see that. My kind of personal highlight was the film La Cocina, which is by Alfonso Ruiz Palacios, I think is how you say it. I might be wrong, and I apologize for that. He's a Mexican filmmaker, been to Berlinale quite a few times, and this is a sort of dual language feature. It's kind of in Spanish and English, and it's about the lunchtime rush at this New York tourist trap restaurant, and it's about the kind of back of house staff, the chefs and the waitresses, and their kind of interactions. And at the same time, there's kind of these different subplots going on. So there's some money that's gone missing, and the manager is trying to kind of find out what happened, and there's a new waitress who's just started and is kind of, she doesn't speak any English and is kind of trying to figure out how to integrate herself. And then there's this love story going on in kind of the middle of it all between this chef, Pedro, who's very combustible, very charming, played by Raul Briones Carmona, who is like fantastic. I think should have probably won the award for best actor at the festival, but whatever. And the waitress Julia, who's played by Rooney Mara. And yeah, I just found it really invigorating. It's 2 hours 19 minutes, I think, and I was a bit like, oh god, this is gonna be a long one. Because at a film festival, especially when it starts at like 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night, you're like, God, this is going to really like take the life out of me. But I didn't find that at all. I thought it was just a really like engrossing and like kinetic take on not only cooking, but kind of the immigrant dream and the kind of fallacies of the immigrant dream. And yeah, it's based on this play by Arnold Wesker from like the 50s, which was set in London. So the kind of transposition of that plate into like an American setting. The viewers won't be able to see this, but I'm gesturing with my hands so much right now. This is why we need a video podcast. Yeah, I just found it like really brilliant, and it's been picked up by Pitch House, so people will get to see it over here, which is great because I just had such a good time with it. And if you like The Bear and Boiling Point, then get ready for the most stressful, beautifully shot kitchen movie that's kind of come along in recent years. Yeah, I really liked it. And on the kind of note of the festival, you know, the statement they released and the fact they're trying to prosecute members of their own staff for quote unquote misusing social media, it's just like Berlinale has always kind of prided itself on being, you know, this really like liberal festival. They were one of the first to like recognize queer cinema in their Teddy Award, and they have like gender neutral categories now for like acting awards. And having, you know, I've lived in that city, like Berlinale is one of the first, like, maybe the first festival I ever attended, and it's so obviously like this feels particularly like kind of horrible to me because I love the city so much and I love the people there so much. And you know, I think it's just so kind of galling to see something that you love betray you in such a way and to be used for these like political purposes by the government. And although we all kind of know that like these institutions do heavily rely on like government funding, and that's true for like pretty much every major film festival, you still kind of want to hope that there's like some autonomy and that they are allowed to kind of speak truth to power. And that's just, it doesn't feel like that's what's happening at all, especially considering that we know that like Panorama, Encounters and Forum, the kind of sidebar sections of Berlinale, have all released statements saying that they are in support of Palestine. And you know, they've tried their hardest to kind of speak out, and yet the institution itself is like, you know, threatening to prosecute them and saying and like agreeing with the mayor of Berlin when he's saying that like Matty Diop was like wrong to speak out. And it's just so like, you know, incredibly depressing. And I'm very grateful to people that did kind of speak up. There was a lot of activity on the ground from film workers for Palestine and from some of the kind of people involved in this. I was like, Raul Briones Carmona kind of made a statement on, I think, I don't know if they mentioned it in the press conference, but definitely on the red carpets, was like wearing a keffiyeh and like had like Free Palestine kind of, I think, a bracelet on as well. And I think there's this film that played in the generation section, Last Swim, and the filmmakers behind that had signs that said Free Palestine. So I'm very grateful that some people did kind of use their platform to speak up, because I think, like,
even in this kind of hostile environment that the festival had cultivated.
Exactly. And if the institutions aren't going to do it, then, you know, I feel like we, the critics, you know, the people going to the cinemas and the filmmakers and the actors and everyone, like, we kind of have to. So, yeah. I maybe my final one for a while, which is a shame, but I just don't see how... thing to say
is that we're going to probably do a bit more on this in the next magazine,
yeah,
which we're sort of like tinkering with currently, and will be coming down the chute sort of middle of next month.
Well, that's something to look forward to, at least. I mean, it's just deeply depressing that, you know, we're not able to be here and just kind of focus on all the wonderful films and filmmakers that, you know, are showcasing their art. I think that moment between you know, the team behind No Other Land, where, you know, I haven't seen the film, but I watched the speech, and, you know, it's the Israeli filmmaker Yuval Abraham and his Palestinian colleague Basal Adra, and just sharing the stage in such like a really beautiful moment of acknowledging each other's humanity, and like the idea that that could be in any ways weaponized against them is bone chilling.
The fact that like that was described as anti-Semitic, like, you're gonna tell a Jewish filmmaker that he's being anti-Semitic. It really does like blow your mind, the kind of hoops that have been jumped through to get to these, like, these leaps of logic, and to how any festival could program that film and then turn around and say, oh, actually.
Well, it really does speak of a kind of maybe an unspoken chasm between the programmers, the, you know, the actual kind of people who love film and art and engage with the world, and the kind of bureaucracy who want to see, you know, who are setting the rules and want to see kind of numbers in a spreadsheet.
Well, before we all kind of spiral fully into despair, more trouble in the Middle East in June part two. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member, who receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. Dune Part 2 follows the mythic journey of Paul Atreides as he unites with Chani and the Fremen whilst on a warpath of revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. Facing a choice between the love of his life and the fate of the known universe, he endeavours to prevent a terrible future only he foresees. Before we got into the film, here's David Jenkins talking to Denis Villeneuve.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk to us for this podcast.
My pleasure.
I guess so. Congratulations on the movie.
Thank you.
I loved it, and I loved the first one as well. And it's a rare example of a sequel that kind of delivers on the original one as well. I mean, from the production process of making this second film, how much of the work had you done with the first one? Did you feel like the first film had sort of set the template for the second one, or were you kind of going back to the drawing board?
It's a good question. The first movie technically was a massive rehearsal to make the real movie, which was the second one, because the first one there. First of all, we had more time in pre-production for the research and development of part one was long. I'm talking about the visual effects. For the music tests, we did numerous amount of camera tests. Part one was a huge laboratory, and that gave. And once we found all the answers, when we went into part two, we had already all those decisions that were being made about the cinematic language that we would use, the rhythm, the camera work, the camera style, the VFX department that had done tremendous amount of tools to be able to create those VFX. And so it's like we were like we had that toolbox ready. Mm-hmm. And my production designer Patrice Vermette had already started to design part two, because we were projecting in the future. Like when you were starting to describe the Fremen world to ourselves. We wanted to know where we were going, or just for the Aumin. So like the sieges or the temples or the development on Ornithopters or what Gedi Prime could look like, or the Patrice was dreaming forward, you know, he was like already in the future, and then so we were like a step ahead when started the pre-production of part two.
Well, I guess that's really handy to know where you're going in advance.
Absolutely.
So like,
yeah that's it. When I did part one, I had a blueprint of what the screenplay will be for part two. Of course, it was like there was like a plan, even if the it was not absolutely finished. And the same for my team. I will say that they were more advanced in a way, because we were, as I was writing the screenplay, I knew exactly how things would look like, because we knew we had designed it already too.
So I'd love to know about the, if you could talk a little bit about the practicalities of shooting in the desert. The first film is more kind of, I guess it covers more kind of interior space, mm-hmm. in kind of castles, and I don't know if you call that, that's not a castle, but you know, sort of big, huge kind of monument buildings. And this one, you're kind of is the sort of nature, the yin to the kind of urban yang of the first one. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to know, just what is your strategy for shooting in the desert, for capturing the vastness?
But it's when I embarked on this journey, I had one condition, which was to shoot in real environments, that I will not shoot this movie in front of green screen in a studio or on the back lot, as I had been suggested by, I said to everybody, if I'm doing this, I'm going deep in the desert for real, because the book is about the relationship between the humans and the ecosystems, and the impact of those ecosystems, of the environment on humans, that develops their psyche, their religions, techniques, etc. And it's like, I wanted to feel the power of the desert, and that it would have been absolutely impossible to bring back these images home without having been there for real. It was, I think, even with the perfection of visual effects, you still need to capture reality in order to bring to the audience, perceive it. You feel it when it's real on camera. You physically know that it's the real thing, and that you're somewhere back in your conscious, you perceive it, and when you make a sci-fi film, the power of nature is your strongest ally.
Oh, absolutely. And I understand that you were shooting some of the scenes that were shot at kind of magic hour as well. Mm-hmm. And can you tell me a bit about shooting at that time, and what the value of it aesthetically and emotionally is?
But the thing is that it's linked with the story we're telling, talking about, is that it's these people try to avoid the middle of the day, because the planet becomes too hot. You know, it's like dangerous for humans to be outside. You have to walk outside. We see some characters that are like not fit for the desert, that you need to wear some kind of space suit to be able to evolve in the such harsh environment. So the native people that are used to be on Arrakis, that are from Arrakis, are most of the time traveled by night, or will be outside just at the day breaks or at sunset. I mean, that's where they are traveling. And but to do so, it was important. It means that we will have to work in very specific light conditions, and I insisted also with Greg to use exclusively natural light, the sunlight, to bring that level of realism and that sensation.
And how does that work with IMAX cameras?
It's not a problem with IMAX cameras, but it's definitely a problem for the schedule, because it means that you will, if you do a dialogue between two characters, that, and of course, a dialogue will necessarily take a couple of hours to shoot, and you have a window of time that will be maybe 20 minutes where you can shoot. So it means that you have to break that scene over many days in order to keep the continuity of the sunlight from one shot to the others, which means that the actors will need to perform and find back the exact emotional state where we are shooting over many days. And that requires a lot of focus for the actors and for myself to be able to convey a feeling of pure emotional continuity between the shots that are being shot among several days. It's even more tricky when we did some action sequence, because I didn't want to make any compromises. The landscape and the logic of the landscape and the dramatic elements that I was looking in the landscape required that we will shoot scenes in different places, sometimes 10, 12 different places in order to have perfect shots, but at specific time of the day in order to create that visual continuity and that aesthetic quality we were looking for. It was like a puzzle. It was really a puzzle for my first assistant here.
Talking of the action scenes, for me, there was something, the spectacle and the uniqueness of them gives the film this real sense of, like, I guess, a wow factor as well. And in particular, I love the fact that you're kind of, that when you have, like, for instance, when there is this sort of siege on the spice harvester, you kind of, you have all these planes of vision and you have, like, things blowing up in the background, and the human characters are often the people who are in focus, and you see the machines, mm-hmm. kind of, like, you know, that they're almost sort of like details in the landscape. And that's purely my visual interpretation of watching the film. But I'd love for you to talk about, like, how you deal with the spectacle in the film, because the action scenes are immense.
But the thing is that it's a very basic rules, but first of all, in the screenplay, we try our best to make sure that through the action, there will always be a precise story that is being conveyed. You do the action is almost secondary. It's like it's there to create momentum, but through each action sequence, you have like a precise emotional beat that the character will go through, and that it's not just action for the sake of action. There's really like each has its own meaning, if I can say. And from there, it means that, of course, if I approach those action sequences like a dramatic sequence, it's like then the center of attention will be, of course, the character that is going through this, and I will make sure that as the scene evolves, that we are following this character and his emotional journey through this sequence. So it means that he's going to be a foreground, and now I will say also that Dune is a sci-fi movie, but it's all the technical aspects are a bit in the background. The focus is always the characters.
It's true. I mean, that's interesting you say that, because another sort of thing that I felt while watching it was that I was less thinking about kind of classic sci-fi movies and more about kind of things like David Lean or Sergio Leone, mm. and these kind of like epic desert films that are like historical adventure films. I wondered if those type of films, like a Lawrence of Arabia, had ever...
A Lawrence of Arabia is inevitable. I cannot pretend that it was not a major influence on the making of this film, because the book itself, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, I think in English, which is a book that influenced Frank Herbert to write Dune. The book came out after the movie, so I'm sure that there was some influence even in the film that had an impact on Herbert. The story of Lawrence of Arabia and Paul Atreides has some strong similarities. So it's, of course, as a film student, I still remember today how I felt once the curtain, the lights went on after watching Lawrence of Arabia on 70mm alone in a theater in Montreal. It was one of the most powerful theatrical experience, cinephile experience of my life. And it's a masterclass into cinema language. And the way David Lean used the power of nature to express the power of that nature, how the impact on the psyche of the character, and how he was able to create a perfect equilibrium between the emotional journey of Lawrence and all the geopolitics in the film still amaze me today, and of course is a massive influence.
Can I talk about the role of Paul Atreides and Timothy's performance as well? I love this aspect of the film where Paul, I mean, and this is very much from the book, that he's not a kind of cut and dried hero, and that although he is kind of being presented as this messiah and may well be this messiah, there is that you sort of bring in the sense of ambiguity about him and his kind of onward journey. And I'd love for you to talk a bit about how you work with Timothy to get the kind of fine tuning of that character, because it's so detailed, and I think there is a sort of hints of like malevolence there and that are hidden under the kind of charisma and the heroism.
The thing is that I have to go back in time very when the first book was released, Frank Herbert, from what I understood, was disappointed the way the book was perceived, the way Paul Atreides was perceived by readers, where it seems that at the time people were seeing this as a celebration of a hero, and he wanted to do the radical opposite, which was like a cautionary tale about charismatic figures. He wanted the Dune to be a warning. And for that, in order to correct that and to make sure that people will understand his idea, he went and wrote an epilogue, a tiny book called Dune Messiah, to try to make sure that people understand that. And me knowing that story, it was the main influence how I will do this adaptation, trying to be less faithful to the book, more absolutely faithful to Frank Herbert's initial intention to do that the movie will be as he is intended, a warning and a critic of colonization and of the idea of cult, the leaders that create cult of fanatism of it was important that Paul Atreides will because of the decision he's facing and the choice he's making will become slowly what he was afraid to, what he was fighting against, he will, in order to survive and protect the people he loves, he will have to make decisions that will create tremendous chaos and it's a tragic figure. It becomes a tragic figure. The movie becomes a tragedy, and for me that was the most interesting. In fact, it was fundamental to go in that direction. Mm. And that's and in order to do so, I use the power of two female characters that kind of go into the background in the book, and but I bring kept them at the surface of, and keep them as main protagonist in the story, which are Lady Jessica and Shani, who helped me to create critical distance with Paul's character and express, more specifically Shani, to express what I want to say with that story. And I didn't answer to your question, I'm sorry, about Paul Atreides, about Timothée Chalamet. Timothée is a very brilliant young man, and since even in part one knew exactly the trajectory where we were going, and what we had to establish at the beginning, that kind of candor and open-minded and flexibility of his character, capacity of the adaptation and sincerity, that I think that Paul really wants to help the Fremen. He really wants to, he's sincere, and there's like a slowly progressive cynicism that realizes that he will have to face his fate and become something that he was trying to fight against.
Thank you so much for your time. It was lovely speaking to you.
So, David, I mean, some of the criticism around Dune 1, which is a film I absolutely adored, was that it just felt like half of a film. Do you think this sequel kind of suffers from the same thing? Are we watching essentially just one film with a chunky interval?
I mean, it's interesting how the film picks up at the exact spot where the first one leaves off. So it's very much a kind of like chronological continuation of the storyline from that point. You know, you may complain about that, but so many films have done that in the history of cinema, where you kind of, it's like an intended trilogy or like a sequel, you know, it's intended two-parter where it has to leave it a kind of slight cliffhanger moment that is kind of bring you back. And I think the thing with that has plagued people who have made Dune, have adapted the novel Dune, is this idea of like, what, you know, how do you partition it? You know, what, how do we present it? Like, you know, the Lynch version in 1984 is very flawed in that you kind of, I mean, the version that Dino De Laurentiis kind of sliced back is this kind of 2.5 hour real truncation of the book to an almost comic degree, where it's like, you feel like everything is being told in this kind of super fast and, you know, slightly chaotic montage. And then you've got like the various TV series. Well, there was a TV series made of it as well, which is just deathly dull. And it's just way too long. And you're like, oh my God, will this thing hurry up? And then I think what Denis Villeneuve has done with these two films is kind of, I think he's sort of found a happy medium between the two. So we've got sort of two fairly chunky features that are kind of, you know, getting the best out of the book, not being too literal adaptations, and trying to sort of get as much in as possible. And I think that with these two Dune films, you have the most balanced version in terms of like, this is a fun epic to sit through, and it's getting a lot of the stuff from the book, but it's not, you know, it's not going too over the top, or it's not going too quick. So yeah, this the what we get in this part two is like roughly from like, you know, it's roughly the whole second half of the novel. You get all the freaky stuff. The novel for me is a little bit more psychedelic. You know, it's got this kind of long passages of like, you know, psychedelic prose when Paul and his mother take the water of life, which is this kind of serum that is extracted from the baby sandworms. And there's a really amazing scene where you see that process happening, and it's kind of, it's this blue liquid that's like poisonous for most people, but if you have some like godly gene, then you know you can withstand it and you transcend, which is what Paul does. But yeah, it's a really kind of measured film. I mean, I think that, you know, there's so much to say about it, but that I could go on forever, but like, I think maybe I'll pass the baton on to Hannah.
Oh, Hannah, I mean, so many things to ask you, but you know how much I love Rebecca Ferguson, and she's such a delightful weirdo in this film. I mean, what did you think of the sort of supporting performances? I mean, she's essentially playing a different character, but we're also getting new characters in the form of Christopher Walken and Florence Pugh, and you know, Zendaya really gets a lot more time in the sun.
Yeah, it's such a stacked cast, isn't it? Like, I remember when it was announced, it was kind of like, oh my God, how many celebrities can you fit into this bad boy? Especially when at the premiere, the London premiere, they were like, surprise, Anya Taylor-Joy is in this as well. And everyone was like, what? Another one? Yeah, no, I mean, they kind of make it, especially because Paul, I think, is not like that exciting of a character. In fact, I remember my Letterboxd review for the first one was like, I love how everyone else reacts to Paul, just like Michael Bluff in Arrested Development when he sees George Michael's girlfriend. He's like, her? Like, that's how everyone feels about Paul in Dune. They're like, him? Apart from Javier Bardem, who was just like, I love this guy, like the second like he meets him. And I did enjoy throughout this film, like, Layla was sat next to me, so I think you would agree with me that every time he opened his mouth, it's just
so
like,
funny,
hilarious. Like, he just has all these like kind of very funny little kind of moments where like Paul does something and he's just like, oh, he's the Messiah. Like, and it's just really funny.
He's like, oh, I'm not the Messiah. Oh, that's what the Messiah would say.
Ah, here's the ultimate Stan.
It's literally like Life of Brian levels of kind of like comedy from Javier Bardem. He's great. And yeah, no, I very, very much enjoyed everyone else. I liked Zendaya in kind of what I think is like a bit of a 1D. I mean, I've not read Dune, so sorry all the Dune stands, but like, I don't know, some of these characters don't seem, they all seem kind of like, you know, just a sort of like cog in a machine rather than like three-dimensional people, which is, you know, fine. I think it's all symbolism, isn't it? But yeah, I liked her. I thought Austin Butler did a really good job as Fade Ruther. Anyway, the bald psychopath is how we should just accurately describe him. He's doing this like voice, which is like, it's not Elvis, it's not Austin Butler, it's a secret third thing. And he's really good. I would watch a movie that's just him like being a creepy dude, like
just a kinky little freak.
creepy little guy feeding humans to his like weird harem
fetish dolls,
women fetish dolls. Yeah, I actually think we could have done with more of him, because he basically has two scenes and they're great scenes, but like, it's, yeah, he's just really fun. He's clearly having such a good time because he's so used to being like brooding handsome guy, and in this they're like, no, just be a little freak. And he, that's exactly what he is. He's like Nick Holt in Mad Max Fury Road levels of like unselfconscious. And I just very here for it. I think he's really good. And then, yeah, like Florence Pugh is there.
She couldn't be on the press tour for Don't Worry, Darling, Lest You Forget.
Yeah, it's so funny. They were like, oh, she's just like June. She's got all these scenes to record for June, and then she's in it for like, I don't know, maybe 15 minutes max. She's important. Like, she's very important to the story, but she's not in it an awful lot. But whatever, it's fine. Yeah, I mean, and obviously Rebecca Ferguson is great. Yeah, like you said, she gets a completely different character in this. She's much more like ooky, spooky lady than in the first one. She was kind of just being like maternal but stern mother presence. And this, she's like, I am the, I don't know what she's called, like the mother of God.
Bene Gesserit.
No. She's got a special, like a name, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Like a special name. You know what I mean?
Reverend Mother.
Yeah, but I thought they called her something else. I need to watch it again. I would quite happily watch it again. Which again, like that, for a film that is 2.5 hours, for me to be like, fuck yeah, let's go again. It's that doesn't happen that often. And I'm starting on Josh Brolin. Josh Brolin's great. Like, so, yeah.
I actually think that there's an interesting, like, one of the things I really like about this film is that I think, you know, you hinted at it, but you do, like, the characters change so much from the first one. Like, I mean, obviously we get like the Paul Atreides arc where, you know, in the first one he's a sort of like slightly whingy little bitch who doesn't really you know, who doesn't really get what's going on, and there is a sense of him being a little bit of a kind of entitled weed, and only by the end does he kind of show that he is actually kind of has some kind of worth to him. And then, yeah, he goes on this kind of journey of like being like, well, am I this like messiah figure that everyone is talking about? I think it's really interesting not only how he deals with that idea of like, well, I may not be it, but I can use it for good, and I can use it to kind of like create, you know, do this big fight back, which is basically my kind of purpose here, because, you know, I want revenge on the Harkonnen invasion and destruction of my people. And I actually think that Zendaya, like, you know, you have these characters who are introduced as like, oh, Zendaya, she's the love interest. But then by the time a little bit of that story is played out, it kind of like moves off into this different direction where you really feel that she quite, you know, she's starting to resent him because she's got her own ideas about, well, this is the reasons why we should be doing this thing. And then, you know, Rebecca Ferguson as well, you know, she's like, once she drinks the crazy juice, she's a completely different character, and she's got
her. She gets blue-pilled.
Yeah, she does. She does really get blue-pilled. And it is, you know, there is a kind of like, what's fun about this film is that it has this kind of, you know, it's very quote unquote relevant to, you know, lots of kind of geopolitical ructions and modern philosophy and also quite a lot of pop culture and sociology as well, and this idea of like conspiracy theories and the sort of puppets behind the puppets behind the puppets. Talking of which, you know, just on the note of the supporting cast, you know, want to rep for Christopher Walken.
do you though?
Big Chris. It's his like first film in like 4 years. I found, you know, him playing the Emperor of the Known Universe quite moving, I thought. And it was nice to see him back.
I did think like Dave Bautista could have been given a bit more to do in this, because I think he's so good in that role. He has like one really good scene. But I mean, this is the problem. Like, there's so many great players in this. It's almost like you can't kind of fit all of them in with enough screen time. I mean, even like Stephen McKinley Henderson didn't even get to come back.
This is the weird thing about Dave Bautista's character is this kind of like fail son lummox type, and he doesn't
Gorō Miyazaki.
Wow, yeah, and you don't really. he doesn't really betray that idea of, like, naturally he doesn't really betray that idea of bumbling idiot, whereas like I maybe think the casting of his character is a little bit off, because he is a kind of, you know, he's just generally a sort of stronger, more authoritative guy in his sort of general vibe, and here he's meant to be playing like, oh sorry, I've mucked up again, doll, you know.
Well, like, I think it works, but I think he's so kind of like, he tries so hard and fails so far, to quote Linkin Park. I mean, I think a great bit of casting, which we've kind of, I assume if they do another movie, which I think they're kind of hoping, Villeneuve's hoping, yeah, he can do another one.
I think he said that he basically wants to do, obviously this is one book and then the next one. Yeah, not to spoil it, but like, yeah, that would actually, even though there are more sequels, that would be quite a solid conclusion to the trilogy.
That's what he said, it would be the end of like a trilogy if he does a third one. But like Leia Sadu like pops up for like a scene, and I assume that she would be like important. So it's kind of like setting up an Anya Taylor-Joy's character, who I won't spoil who that is, but like, yeah, there's kind of things where you're like, oh, are they going to come back? Is this going to be like another extra thing? So I did find that a bit like, damn it, now like we need another one. Even the end of the film, you're like, oh, god damn it. Like it's not like a definitive ending, which I get is the nature of the source material. But I mean, I genuinely don't care. Just had such a great time with it. It is like... So we were talking about the film in our group chat, and someone said, I can't remember who it was, one of my friends said, Denis Villeneuve is the only filmmaker who got better once they got big budget movies. And I have to agree. I think he actually is one of the few filmmakers who really can work at that scale, and like it not feel kind of overwhelming, or overwhelming to him.
I mean, it's probably worth mentioning, like, you know, we talked a lot about the actors and the story, but like, yeah, his work and the design of the film and the scale, in a way, I mean, it's a film that mostly takes place, you know, a lot of the film is people talking in a desert, but then
or in caves,
and then suddenly yeah, you'll have this big set piece that is very in a weird way quite sparsely done. You know, it doesn't have all this kind of like, you know, he's not doing a kind of Transformers type thing where you've got like, it's just pure visual chaos. You know, there is a kind of feng shui to the way he, you know, designs the frame. I agree that I think it's maybe got more satisfying as it's gone on, and you've seen, you know, it makes films like Arrival and Blade Runner feel like kind of sand, well, almost sort of like sandboxes for the work that he's actually come and done here. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like Blade Runner 2049, but yeah, I'm inclined to agree.
I think as much as I kind of came in having loved the first one and, you know, expected to be impressed, expected to find it interesting, I've read the books, I was most shocked by just how much fun it was. Like, I love water skiing and I want to ride a sandworm more than I want to do anything else on this planet. And like, I was thinking about it afterwards, because I think at times it is so funny that I don't know that I've ever laughed in a Villeneuve film before. Aside from one moment in Sicario where they explain that Benicio del Toro's whole deal is that they dropped his family in a vat of acid. Like, you know,
I don't think the
logistics of that. Yes, unintentional. But like, it does seem like maybe, you know, like with that bigger budget, with this sort of like freedom, because everything he's done so far basically has worked, that like he was just having a bit more fun with it all.
Yeah, I think so. We kind of talked about this after the movie. Like, there's some bits in the film you're like, I don't know if he intended for that to be funny, but it is. But then there's also bits where you're like, oh, this is very clearly meant to be. There's like a beat, you know. And I think, yeah, certainly, like, because he didn't know if he was going to get to make this film, I think actually getting to do it must have kind of been, you know, a bit of a like, okay, we can loosen up and, you know, enjoy it, which is like good, because the Dune books fundamentally are kind of like wacky. Like, very, very serious, but also like there's some kind of mad stuff going on in them. And even like Paul being like, what's that little rat mouse thing that you guys have in the desert? I want to be called like rat mouse, basically. Like, yeah, it's just really fun. It is like at a time when I feel like I've been saying this for a year now, or over a year, but like it does feel like something that is going to get people into cinemas, and we need a couple of those, don't we? Every year we need like big get the cinemas to pay their rent movies, and Yeah, it's just really fun.
We know we're talking from advantage of the film not having come out yet, so we don't know how it's going to do at the cinema, but it does. There is a, you know, maybe I'll eat my words on my next appearance, but it does feel like this is going to be a huge thing. Yeah, the first one did well rather than a kind of mega hit. It was like a, you know, sizable hit. Yeah,
$500 million.
Yes, but $500 million plus Oscar nominations. Yeah. It's sort of like
that's the gravy. But like, you know, it really feels like we're kind of racking up examples of these like quality auteur driven blockbusters that aren't just like, oh, you come and make a film under our banner and do it by strictly adhering to our brand guidelines. You know, it's actually like, no, you go and do your thing, the thing that makes you, and people want that now. And so like this could be quite a sort of like weirdly epochal film in many ways if it does well, in that will we suddenly see a kind of like, right, we want the big directors who are maybe currently being courted for like Marvel movies to actually go and do their kind of weird personal project or do a big blockbuster that with some big names that we might not have otherwise done. But I guess that's kind of hopeful. Success so often dictates what happens next, like financial success.
I've so longed for the world that we once had where it was Jurassic Park, not Jurassic World Dominion.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I guess like we've got a couple coming down the pipeline. I'm interested to see what Lee Isaac Chung does with Tremors.
Twisters.
Oh, God. Sorry, I'm on the worms. I'm still thinking about giant worms.
That's the transition between the two. You have Dune, Tremors, Twisters.
On like a Venn diagram, Tremors is in the middle.
Is it windy? Is it? Yeah, sorry.
We've cracked the code.
How big are the worms?
Yeah, I'm excited to see that. I mean, I think I'd rather take big auteurs doing just like a remake of some random, or a sequel in the case of Twisters, some random 80s film than like Marvel movies now. I'm just give me something like a little bit different. Although like I would love original blockbusters more than anything. It's, you know, I just I need kind of escapism. And I don't even think the Marvel movies are escapism now. I think it's just...
They're the prisons.
They are. They're the prisons. I want to go and like ride worms around with Timothy and Josh Brolin.
Yeah. And
that's the sound bite.
It's just so
podcast.
Cool when not only are they surfing the worms, but you can put up a little tent on the worms.
Yes.
So cool.
But also you can be transported in a sort of like little womb by somebody also. Like at one point I was like, the core strength of these people on the worms is really something to behold.
They cannot lose.
I did think like the worms are kind of like, I don't know, like a sentient transport system. Because like...
They're basically like tube trains.
They're just like... Yeah, they're like, oh, I'm just gonna go and call a worm. It's like an Uber.
Okay, can't unsee that. Really excited to rewatch it with that framework. Let's get some scores on this. David, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I'm gonna go for like probably like high fours across the board. I have a few niggles with bits and bobs of like, especially I think that the finale of the film maybe feels a little bit underdone. Like it's one of those weird cases where I maybe would have liked to have added a few 10-15 minutes more just to kind of like ramp up the sense of import of this kind of big final duel that happens in the film. But the sort of final 45 minutes does happen in this kind of almost a little bit of a mad dash, and just sort of goes like the first 2 hours are so great that this final bit doesn't quite live up to them, just because you're not getting the same interest in the detail and the world and the gizmos and the characters. It's a rush of narrative and it's just not quite as good. So yeah, like it's a sort of a high recommendation, but not quite perfect scores.
Hannah, what about you?
Yeah, I think I'm probably the same for very similar reasons. I just think, yeah, the final act, which all kind of takes place in one room, is a bit like, oh, shit, we need to end the movie. We've only got like $50 million left. Quick, put everyone in the same room and let's hash it out. But I was, yeah, I mean, as I've made quite evident throughout this conversation, I was very entertained and I am excited to watch it again. And I think more films could do with like these sort of big swing performances and giant worms. Like, you know, you just stick them in anything. All of us strangers with giant worms. Imagine that.
We'll think of nothing else. yeah, I mean, not to be boring, but yeah, I think I'm about the same 4-4-4. I do think that there were some elements where, particularly like Chani's character is quite different from the book, particularly how she reacts to sort of the final twist in the tale. And I don't know that that was as empowering as they thought it would be. I kind of actually preferred how she originally was. Although Zendaya is fantastic throughout. I don't even really know what to say. It's a really fun time at the movies. I'm extremely happy that it exists. I disagree that Christopher Walken was good, but Rebecca Ferguson letting her freak flag fly was, you know, like more than compensated that for me. And I mean, one of my favorite moments was reminding the person sat next to me that wasn't you, Hannah, that we did technically get naked Oscar Isaac in this one. And they leaned to me and said, like, oh, I wonder who'll be naked in this one. And good Lord, a choice is made.
So some jump scares in this.
But next up, it's Spaceman.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
An astronaut is sent to the edge of the solar system to collect mysterious ancient dust, finds his earthly life falling to pieces. He turns to the only voice who can help him try to put it back together. It just so happens that that belongs to a humanoid spider from the beginning of time, lurking in the shadows of the ship. Before we get into the weird and wonderful world of Spaceman, here's Hannah Strong in conversation with Paul Dano and her beloved Adam Sandler.
He's just a little guy on his journey, he's like cuddly. Me.
That's good. It did that for me, too. I used to have really? a reoccurring dream okay. about spiders. Yeah, would wake up, swat at things, you know, the whole thing.
Really?
Like in the film? Like spiders. Yeah. So this is like therapy for you, basically. Like, I'm going to confront it. Yeah, I'm going to get in the mind of the spider.
Make friends with it, yeah.
I guess I want to start about asking, it's been a long time now, this film's been in, kind of in production, and you both came to it at kind of different points in its life. I would love to hear about the first conversation you had with Johan about it. Adam, I know that this was like right before it was even kind of in production. Yeah. And I know Paul was a little bit later. So
You mean like what the conversation was about floating around the whole time and stuff?
How this was sold to you.
I read this. I met Johan at a hotel. He was a cool dude, walked in with a cane, looked badass. And then he said, I have a script you might like. I said, great, man, sent it over. I read it. I thought it was tremendous. And I said, you want me for this? And he said, yeah. We'd have fun. And something about it really was fresh to me. And my relationship with Hanush was, that was cool as hell. And so I was in. And then 2 weeks before the shoot, Johan said, you realize it's zero gravity, right? And I said, yeah. And in my head, I was like, do we have a place that we float around and stuff? I didn't realize. And then he said, well, so you'll be wired up the whole time. And I said, oh, God damn it. I didn't know that. So that changed my whole, I should have bailed right then.
It's funny because my first impression of Johan is this very big jacket he wore. It might have been a fur jacket like your cane, where who is this guy rolling in here with his...
he's cool.
And he's a... Is Johan a former pop star or something?
Yes.
Sweden?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So he's still, you know, carrying Stock some of the style. Yeah, no, I'd seen his work, and then the script was great and strange. But sometimes a log line is like almost enough, just where you kind of immediately know. So the idea of Adam Sandler on a spaceship talking to a giant spider, it's kind of, right?
Yeah,
that was kind of sold me straight away. Yeah.
Exactly.
The second I heard it was in production.
That's how I felt.
When someone comes to you and says, I want you to play the giant spider, the kind of world-weary, thousands of years old, you're like, yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm down for that.
Yeah.
And Adam, obviously, you were very integral to getting the film made because it's not the kind of film that many studios would take a chance on. And Paul, you've made a film, so I'm sure you know how difficult it is to get a film made. As two people who have been involved in producing, I'm very kind of curious to know how rewarding that kind of extra process is for you guys.
Well, I'll tell you, I expressed my excitement to the Netflix team, and they had the same kind of enthusiasm right away. And they were just—it was just the look of it, what it could be, or I don't know. It was just a new vibe, and they were excited. So they were nice enough to say to jump on and be as enthusiastic as we were.
Mm. And Paul, for you, is it kind of that production side of things? How kind of rewarding is it for you to get to do that as well as the acting?
Yeah, well, I think the more you put in, usually the more you get out.
The more involved
you get to be in something, I generally think the more fun you end up having and the more it gives back to you and the more sort of proud you feel of ultimately handing it over and all of that. That's a real pleasure.
Given that, one of you is a CGI spider in the film, I imagine you didn't spend a lot of time together on the set?
No, but one of my a really good memory for me, because I was a huge fan of Adam's, his acting work, but I remember, listening over and over again to his comedy albums, back when I was in middle school.
That's awesome.
96, 97, those were really important. So the first time I think we met was on Zoom.
Yeah.
And I think we just started reading through the script to kind of see, like, what the hell is this thing? And that was really nice. It was a really nice way to break the ice. It was really fun just to kind of hear it out loud. And we did, I think, several Zoom read-throughs, just kind of chatting through it and feeling it out. And so I stopped by, said a few times. But, yeah, I didn't get to be there every day.
When you did stop by, though, it was like an extra great feeling of, Paul, I remember the last, some of the last moments of the movie Paul was there for and saying goodbye to each other and stuff like that. I was floating pretty far away from you, but knowing you were there felt good.
Mm. How do you kind of build? I mean, I guess you kind of already addressed it, but when you don't have someone physically kind of opposite you as an actor, how do you manage to kind of get into that headspace and create the kind of chemistry without having physically someone opposite you? Because both of you have done VO work before, you kind of know how that all goes.
Well, I got to look, I mean, I worked to playback, we had several sessions of kind of working different ways, one with a kind of mask thing in case they needed to use facial expressions. And then, but so I was working opposite the cut, with Adam. It was just not in the flesh. And again, we'd had these rehearsals, I'd come by set. Also, strangely, like being in a dark room alone is very freeing. So I actually kind of liked it. I was kind of like, this makes me feel loose, you know.
Me too.
I actually found it to be a lot of fun.
Me too, yeah.
You kind of had your own little booth that you were in, which is the spaceship.
Sure, exactly. And then I had to get to a lot. We went to interesting places in our brains. And
you had people pushing you around. Like, I mean, that's a whole different bag because you're sort of deluding yourself into...
Yes.
When there's four other people moving your wires.
Feeling hands on you while you're supposed to be floating is you can break. That went away after a day or two. The guys were great. They put on their outfits. They were hidden in green. I'd feel their hands on occasion moving me around and turning me and stuff like that. But a lot of times it was just in wires floating there alone. Johan would kind of set the camera up. In a way, from like a crane, so the everybody was maybe 100 feet away from me. I was in my own world. It was freeing. And talking to Hanush and knowing and like you said, our rehearsals, I knew who was going to be there, and I knew the voice, and it felt great.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you already kind of know you've had your little rehearsals, it's a little bit easier to visualize the tennis ball as...
Yes, that's right.
I guess maybe being put out there is so much about loneliness in this movie.
Exactly.
Right?
Well,
exactly.
I was going to ask about this because
put out there.
It mm-hmm. feels like your experience is making it, being kind of separate, like reflecting what's happening in the film.
That's right.
And kind of more generally, did you feel like there was any kind of connection between the art of filmmaking itself and what's going on in the film? Because I feel like it can be a lonely kind of life. You're traveling away a lot. And
it can be, yes. It does, depending on how long a trip it is. It can break your heart, and you're sitting in a trailer missing your everyday life. But it's also very exciting. Mm.
I think acting can be kind of lonely. You're like prepping alone in your hotel room or your trailer.
That's true.
Or like
that's
whatever,
true.
And then you're always like, who am I? And, you know.
Yeah. When is it enough? When is it enough? I say,
am I ever enough?
Will my grandma love me now?
Yeah.
A lot of that.
You're getting really existential in your hotel rooms, guys. So. And I mean, the voice for Hanush, I would love to kind of have an ASMR style, like audiobook thing, because I found it so soothing.
Very soothing.
So for you, what was the kind of starting point? get Johan, be like, he can produce it. He's got a music background.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk about Jakob in a minute. But first with Hanush, like when someone says, here's this ancient, almost kind of a god figure, that spider. How do you kind of then think, okay, right, what would that sound like?
Well, there was something, he felt a bit like a doula to me or something. Mm-hmm. So I think a sort of calm, experienced, you know, sort of wisdom, gentle touch, some kind of spiritual guide, right? So I think, again, just in our little rehearsals, just started sort of intuitively in that direction. And then I think I remember testing with Johan, could it be more? And I think it felt best when it sort of lived in the simplest, calmest place. Mm-hmm.
And nothing threw off Hanush. Nothing got him riled up. little case of disappointment on occasion.
Little case of disappointment, and I think that Nutella got him a little.
Yeah.
Little,
he liked it.
Yeah, little worked up, but yeah.
Even getting like, you know, what's it like, desanitized? What's the word? You know, like you.
Oh sure, yeah.
Took it very well. I wouldn't handle that with kind of such serenity. You know, someone spraying me with bacterial spray, I'd be like, come on now. Like,
yeah. Well, he had the power, right? He's like, oh, this sweet little guy is scared.
Skinny human.
Yeah.
But I know what's up.
Very skinny human at the time. At the time, they should call him that.
And for Jakob, obviously, you know, the book is an incredible resource as well. But for you, what was your kind of process going in with finding kind of the headspace he's in the character?
I listened to Johan a lot. I did call the author of the book. He's a very nice guy. And he told me a lot of thoughts he was having when he wrote the book. And then Johan told me what he was thinking when he worked on the screenplay. And, all, you know, you just hear, you take pieces from everybody throughout the process, and then eventually you commit to your own thoughts, and that's how we did it.
I mentioned earlier, kind of both of you have worked in voice work. You know how that goes now, but I was curious to know if there's any kind of ways your process differs when you're doing live action versus voiceover, if it's kind of still prepping in the same way.
I sort of want to lie and say that, but I do think like it's going in front of people is scarier, and I think I probably do.
Yeah,
just do more. It's just it's a whole different bag. It really is. You know, once
being
you're
alone in a booth.
Being alone in a booth. There's a lot of freedom there, and it's sort of. I don't know that I really I've not done a ton of it, and I was surprised how much I enjoyed that.
You don't feel like space. You're wasting anybody's time if you screw up in the booth. You say, "Let me go again." When you screw up with a crew of 200, you're like, "I apologize, everybody."
A kind of key, but we've mentioned it already a little bit, but a key bonding moment between Jakob and Hanush in the film is when Jakob introduces Hanush to Nutella, which is like watching a baby in a towel for the first time. It's very, very sweet. I'm curious to know if you had to introduce a giant benevolent spider to any earthly kind of product.
Oh, that's good.
What would that be?
Wow.
Nutella is up there. You have
Nutella is really good. I mean, the first two things coming to mind are just a really fine piece of sushi.
Oh,
nice.
And then the sort of the opposite, like a simple bowl of cereal.
Yes, like quarter pounder would be nice.
Oh wow,
imagine a quarter pounder. How wonderful that would be for this spider.
Oh yeah.
You'd have to go explain the whole concept. Does the spider know what a pound is? Like.
Yeah, this spider in particular knows the pound, but didn't know the taste of the quarter pound. But would probably say, how did this happen? Why are the onions tasting so good? That's a proper amount of ketchup.
By the time you finish going through it all with them, the whole world's ended already. Well, had a good final moment together. My final kind of question, sci-fi more generally feels like a very kind of, it presents these infinite possibilities for kind of exploring emotion. I'm curious if you have any kind of favorite sci-fi movies.
Oh, wow.
Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot a bit there.
There's a bunch. I remember watching, I watched some good ones Saturday afternoons with my father. I remember laying in bed, putting on I can't come up with the titles right now. I remember the 50-foot woman?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
The Attack of the 50-foot
woman. Is that what, yeah.
Right, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Gosh, that was fantastic. Everything. Soylent Green. What is the one with the Burt Lancaster's? Soylent Green is people?
Yeah, Soylent Green is made of people. Yeah,
that was big. How about you? What are some of yours?
I think mine are more obvious and boring than that. I mean, yeah, I like space is cool. So space is really cool. Yeah, Alien in 2001, of course, or
that was a good.
But grounded sci-fi, Children of Men, even or something.
Yeah,
you can go a lot of different directions with it. But I do like watching space.
And now you're in space. Yeah, great. Yeah,
he's very comfortable in space. Hanush floats around, feels nice.
Doesn't you feel have the more wires, at ease there. Yeah.
He was wireless. I know. How did you do this? Avoided the wires.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Good job.
So, Hannah, I think we should specify that you were not swayed. You saw and loved this film before the Adam Sandler interview carrot was dangled in front of you.
Yeah, no, I saw this before I thought that would ever happen, because I have kind of, since the beginning of my career, since I was 8 years old, probably realistically, wanted to meet Adam Sandler. He is, despite everything, one of the reasons I love movies as much as I do. And I've always been an ardent defender of his, and I campaigned very heavily for the Uncut Gems issue, which obviously went ahead, but we weren't able to speak to him for that. And he doesn't do a lot of press, is the simple thing. So I didn't think that would ever happen, but it did. It did, and it was great. And the interview kind of speaks for itself. He's a lovely guy. And I think a very deep thinker, a lot deeper than people ever want to give him credit for, which is kind of an old, we've been doing that Adam Sandler can act, surprised emoji, conversation for years now. And it's just we have known. But in the case of Spaceman, I was already really interested in the film because I'd read the book, and I'd thought the book was really weird and delightful. And it just seemed like the kind of thing that I've always wanted to see on a big screen, but like it just sounds kind of okay. So it's set in space and there's a giant talking spider. How are you going to do that in a way that doesn't like just instantly become a comedy? But the film is very much, yeah, not a comedy. And I found it like incredibly moving, this like story of this man who is very much like weighed down by his past and like his own relationship with his father, kind of dealing with the idea of like honor and loneliness and letting someone into your life. And kind of it reminds me of like that like joke that was kind of doing the rounds when First Man came out about like men would literally rather go to space than deal with their emotions, like which is kind of exactly what happens in this film. But yeah, it ends up being like this very sad and sweet tale about this man dealing with his trauma through this relationship he builds with a very lovely ASMR sounding talking spider who encounters him and decides he wants to learn about like humanity from this cosmonaut, and he shares Nutella with him and teaches him about that, and they get to know each other, and it's, you get all the kind of information about Jakob's like life and backstory through these kind of flashbacks that the spider Hanush is like prompting. So it, you know, you're kind of coming to know him pretty much at the same time as this giant spider is. And I mean dad stuff always gets me. I have like, sure, I talked about this on the podcast before, like, you know, I find it very affecting. And something like Ad Astra, I think, is like a very kind of relevant like point of comparison. I don't know what it is about like space like seems
to be
good...
going into space.
Yeah, dad's going into space seems to be kind of like fertile ground in the last decade. But I think it really works. I think Sander is such an unusual choice for this part, and I think that some people might say he's miscast. Maybe in another world this would have been like an Oscar, you know, Oscar contender. But I think he does a really good job. I think he balances that kind of like sadness and pathos with the kind of inherent like goofiness of a giant spider in a spaceship. And I think that Johan Renck has made a film that really has a very distinct like feel and look to it. And it was so interesting like talking to him for the pieces online, because he said, oh, whenever I make a movie or a TV show, I ban people from like bringing in pictures from other films and TV shows, because I don't want my product to ever feel like something that they've seen before. And I was just like, at some point you can't avoid it, man, like it just happens. But I think, yeah, that very clear effort to try and like challenge himself as a filmmaker is kind of interesting to me. And I mean, before I let David speak, I will just say as well, like, shout out to Max Richter and Sparks, because the score for this is like great in my opinion. And then there's a song at the end which Max Richter did with Sparks, which is great, and I think way better than anything that ever gets to win an Oscar. So that's my two cents. Yeah, I very much in the can for this one.
I really, really loved it. I also was very lucky enough to talk to Johan, and he's an incredible interviewer, and I was very excited for the two of you to get to talk. But I'm surprised you'd think of this as ever being kind of like Oscar-y, because it's such a weird little thing. I mean, we're talking about Paul Dano voicing a dachshund-sized spider with a child's mouth.
He's massive, isn't he?
When do they specify that in the book?
But in the book.
Oh, sorry, I've mixed up my dog breeds. He's a dog.
Oh,
somewhere between Chihuahua and well, I think it's a little bit My Neighbor Totoro, isn't it? Where it's just like seen to seem like this, the size of him is debatable.
my mom always quotes that bit from Father Ted, you know, with the cows, where they're like, oh, are they small or very far away? It's like watching the film, it's like, is he a small spider or is it the spaceship that's small? Like, I'm not entirely sure, but
another one of life's big questions being asked.
I don't know if the film I would consider like Oscar-y, but definitely that role, you know, lonely cosmonaut, like, I think is very Oscar-y. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad it's not. I'm glad it's its own thing. I don't think it's trying to be awards bait or anything.
David, like for you, like this is Adam Sandler arguably at his least Adam Sandler-y. Did that work for you?
I mean, I'm sort of, you know, I think when I saw it, my instant reaction to it was sort of trying to think back to whether he'd ever done anything this kind of like fully serious before. There are sort of few, if any, gestures towards comedy. I mean, sometimes with someone like Sandler, who is just inherently funny, his mere presence, him just talking and just, you know, you see a photograph of him walking down the street and it's like, it brings a little kind of wry smile to your face. And, you know, this film is very much, we're kind of extracting this image and trying to sort of like flip reverse it for the needs of this film. And there's nothing. I mean, yeah, I can't remember, you know, it's hard to remember a comedy actor going so fully in the tank of something that is so serious. That's not to say, like, I think the film's tone, which is more kind of like, you know, it has a sort of like ethereal, dreamlike energy to it, lots of flashbacks. You know, there is a, you know, it's an emotional film as well. I mean, it is all about a kind of, you know, essentially about a man being partitioned from his wife by the time and space between them on Earth and in this spaceship. You know, it's this idea of like he is there to do this job, and there is a kind of company, you know, there's a bureaucracy who are maintaining him and trying to sort of like make sure he is in a kind of mental state to be able to carry out his important duties, because if he can't, there is no kind of backup there. So it is all about, you know, whilst you've got this kind of, you know, he's kind of relaying these memories of his relationship with his, like, you know, his quite sort of tumultuous relationship with his wife. There's all this other stuff going on at the same time about the sort of management of his psyche in many ways. And that's kind of interesting. But yeah, I mean, you know, if I'm being honest, I probably would, I prefer the kind of the cheeky chappy Adam Sandler rather than the stone-faced serious Adam Sandler. Like, I wouldn't have like said no to a few little dashes of the sort of everyman humor that he brings to kind of all of his roles. You know, even, you know, I don't think a film like his role in Uncut Gems is not a comic role, but it is hilarious. You know, it's like, you know, just because of the way he plays it and does it. But yeah, you don't. This is like fully serious Sandler, FSS.
I feel like, I don't know whether, I mean, because I really like jazz, but like sometimes I think jazz kind of is assumed to just sort of be like a little chaotic and very like instinctual and not have like that technical edge. And this can be a real joy sometimes in watching a jazz musician then kind of switch into doing like a very classic performance, because then you kind of can see that the jazz itself is like a choice. Do you know what I mean? I think there's something in like Sandler making himself wholly disappear in this part that like makes, kind of recontextualizes the other performances in a way that makes them even more fun.
But I mean, it's proof that I think that he's not just a comedy, you know, I think people would have in the 90s and not maybe early noughts pegged him as this kind of comedy actor, and he does Happy Madison films and they come out on Netflix and they're very silly and they kind of serve a very specific function. But, you know, I think that lately he's proving, and not in this kind of contrived way of like, I've got something to prove. It's done in a very kind of natural and very like, you know, the projects he's picked are sort of strangely high quality, that where he's sort of showing, you know, I can do all these other things. Like the comedy is actually part of the performance. It's not just like, you know, a thing that comes naturally to me. So like, you know, I think that the film does offer this showcase of his like breadth as a performer, but in a way that's not a kind of like, that's the reason for the film to exist. I need something to fan out my CV. You know, it doesn't feel like that.
It doesn't have like the sweatiness of like the reconnaissance, I think.
Yeah, because I mean, I don't think he's going. He's not like trying to win an award or anything. You know, he's just like, oh, this seems interesting to me, I'm going to do something different. And I think that's very admirable. And I think that also the fact that he's the entire reason the film got made, because Johan has said, like, I didn't know how I was going to finance this. And then Adam Sandler came along and said, oh, don't worry about it. Like, I have a production deal with Netflix. We'll get it made. I mean, you know, we do hear about these stars who are willing to kind of literally put their money where their mouth is to get films that wouldn't get made. And, you know, I think that is like a very valuable thing to have. You know, he does his silly comedies with the fart jokes and projectile vomiting or whatever, but he also is like, well, I'm not just gonna make those, I'm gonna get Netflix to put their cash behind this like weird 2-hour space film about a giant spider. And I think also it challenges the audience. You know, I think that it is like asking you, if you're not like familiar with Adam Sandler or don't kind of buy him as like a serious actor for whatever reason, it is saying to you, look, like, kind of sit down and shut up and watch this and you know, challenge yourself to actually kind of pay attention. And it was interesting because I saw this on my own, and you know, I think there was kind of safety in that, and I could cry as much as I wanted because I cry at everything. But I was talking to our friend of the pod, Hafa Sells Ross, about this, and she saw it at Berlin and was like, oh, people were laughing in the audience. And I think that's a kind of like, it's almost like a laziness. It's like, okay, are you laughing because it's funny or just because it's Adam Sandler and that's what you expect to do? So I think, like, you know, I like this kind of subversive casting with like intent. It's not just doing it to be like shocking. I think there's such a reason and a purpose behind it. And I'm really glad that Johan sees in Sandler like the potential and kind of wants to not necessarily like change the narrative, but wants to kind of make something interesting with him.
Yeah, I sobbed, but I wasn't entirely sure why I was sobbing. But what of all the reasons to sob, that I think is probably the best one. But do you want to get some scores on this, Hannah, in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I think it's maybe a 4.44, maybe. Might go up to 5 in retrospect. I did watch it a second time, and again, like, I really, really liked it. It didn't kind of dim any. I think maybe the kind of, some of the dialogue's not great, but more between Carey Mulligan and Adam Sandler. I think, like, their scenes are a little bit, I don't know, a little bit kind of awkward. I think she's maybe miscast. I don't think she's as miscast here as she is in Maestro, but, like, she's still, like, yeah, I think it maybe would have been, the age gap's a bit awkward. Like, you know, she's 20 years younger than him. It's not like a awful, it's not criminal, but it's like, you know, it could just be, I don't know.
Well, this is the
awkward
future. Who knows what makeup, what kind of lotions and potions are available to the women of the world.
They should have had Isabella Rossellini in her role. That would have been like,
so good.
That would have been insanely good. But yeah, no, I mean, Paul Dano is great as well. We didn't even kind of talk about how good he is doing his ASMR spider voice. And yeah, I just think it's something very different. And for Netflix, we know how bad some of their original filmmaking could be. So it's great that they're actually, you know, kind of still trying to push the envelope a little bit and put like really interesting stuff out there.
David, what about you?
I'm probably going to go slightly less and I'm going to do a 4.33. I was excited to see it. I saw it after Hannah had seen it. And, you know, I think she sort of pitched it to me in a really interesting way. I felt that I think my issue with it is that it sounds this really intriguing and well articulated note, but then I feel it maybe kind of replays the note a little bit too much, and maybe by the final act, it kind of, it's, for me personally, I think that the final act maybe has a sort of results may vary vibe to it, in that I kind of found it quite maudlin and it was sort of quite aggressively trying to get me to react to it, and that sort of like maybe pushed me away a little bit. But no, I think it's a, you know, I agree with everything you're saying. I think it's a really interesting, well-designed film. You know, it's like, wow, you know, we're seeing an Adam Sandler film that feels like a kind of direct inspiration from like Solaris. You know, it's quite a feat.
Yeah, I think I'm probably at a 3.44. A big fan of Sandler's, but it, you know, it did sound a little bit kind of, you know, self-consciously weird when I was reading what it was going to be about. Yeah, I kind of just got on its wavelength, whatever that might be. And like sure, there are strange elements, and I agree the final act, I think, might alienate a few because it really does go to some unhinged places. But I've, you know, I've been texting Hannah ever since. Like, I miss Hanush. I can't wait to see Hanush again.
I want a spider spirit guide. I think we could all do with that.
I think most of the world's problems, and certainly the issues of the Berlin Film Festival, would be solved if people could just get into a room for 1 hour with Hanush.
I agree.
Yeah, before we go, we've got one last thing. You guys are going to give us your non-movie recommendations. So, David, aside from the movies, what are you recommending?
Well, this is a bit of a weird one. So, like, I wouldn't say this is necessarily a hard recommendation, but every Saturday I take my 5-year-old daughter to street dance classes. And she dances for an hour, and at the end of the term they do a big performance. And last week I discovered that the big theme of the next performance is TV's Gladiators, and so they're doing songs from TV's Gladiators. So like they're doing like I Got the Power and another one, Bites the Dust. And so on the way home, we were walking home together, and she's like, what is the Gladiators, Daddy? And I'm like, that's a good question. And I think the best way for me to explain that is to just show it to you, because I don't think I'm not sure I'm going to explain it in a way that's going to be meaningful for you. So we got back home and went onto iPlayer and we watched one of the new Gladiators, and we had had a fun time doing it, and she completely understood what it was. And then I had to tell her that I watched this as a kid like 30 years ago, and it was different people who were all, you know, OAPs now and probably not as
I wonder what happened to Wolf.
Yeah, the wolf man. But it was, so it's my non-film recommendation is the revival of TV's Gladiators.
Did not see that coming.
Neither did I. Great recommendation.
Hannah, what about you?
David already probably knows what I'm going to recommend. So I got a PlayStation 5 last week, which has been a long time coming, and I have been playing Baldur's Gate 3, which is a Dungeons & Dragons style turn-based RPG game. Really, really doing myself so many favours this week to dollar like a nerd. And you know what? I'm having
haven't
a great
read
time.
June, so still cool.
I'm having a great time with it. My character is a half wood elf rogue, and he is very handsome and very stupid, which is what I was going for, and it's worked out really well. He's a himbo wood elf who doesn't have a clue what is going on at any time, but he's very persuasive. This all kind of, anyway, people that have played it and are listening will understand what I'm talking about. But I'm having a great time. I keep dying a lot. One of the good features of the game is that you can talk to any animal, and it has like a narrator who like narrates your actions in the game. And it, so if you like, there's one bit where it's like there's a squirrel that runs past, and you can talk to the squirrel, and it's like you talk to the squirrel bares its teeth and tries to bite your foot. And it's just like, it's just stuff like that. It's just really silly, but there's this kind of really involved storytelling going on, and there's lots of decision making, and you can play the game in a lot of different ways. So you can talk yourself out of fights or just kind of go in all guns blazing. And yeah, it just really plays to my kind of the side of me. I'm a big like choose your own adventure type person. Those books were like my life as a kid. So I'm really, really enjoying Baldur's Gate 3.
Well, this is the generational divide. You were reading choose your adventure books. I was watching Gladiators. But yeah, thank you both very much for your recommendations and for all of your insights this week. Next week, I get to say next week and not next time. Hurrah! It's Do Not Expect Much from the End of the World, and we spoke to its director, Radu Jude. Ava DuVernay takes on cast and origin, and for Film Club, we revisit Elia Kazan's Pinky. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leigh Latif, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Hannah Strong. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.